Oh, inspirations, I suppose, in my early years growing up. Yeah, keep talking, keep talking, keep talking. Perhaps if that can go back that way a bit from this one. Down, down, down. A bit more. And then I can go up this way. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, it seems. Oh, hello, hello. Yeah, it seems a little bit kind of, yeah, in my face. Thank you. But it needs a new tune. I'm sorry about that. Yeah, so we can give it to someone to do that. Yesterday, I was having a lovely day. I was doing some reading, some bit of writing, bit in the garden, lovely lunch with a friend, chat, chat, chat. And I was really enjoying life. And then I had plans for the evening because I still had a bit more work to do for today. Well, I've got 3 hours. I can, plan what I want to do there. Then I ate my dinner. Then I had 6 hours of pain. And I thought, Ecclesiastes is speaking to me. So, enjoy life. Accept the blessings of God. Enjoy them while you can because darkness is always coming. Yes, anyway, and I got up this morning and thought, it's all right, I'll get up early, I'll finish that, that's all right. And the cat came along and attacked me. He doesn't normally do this, but I thought, well, yeah, okay, I got the message yesterday, I don't need another one. All right, so we're going to attempt to have a little look at Ecclesiastes today. If it gets too heavy, I brought some Lunig. There's a bit of a puzzle about why Ecclesiastes is in our canon. Number of things I've read sort of said, maybe this, maybe that, but actually we don't know. One reason that might have been included in the Jewish canon is its traditional connection with Solomon. And even though it was written far too late to be Solomon, it's not really regarded as a thing. Another one is that it's in the canon because it's been framed by beginning and end, some stuff that makes it look like, oh yeah, that looks orthodox, which may be later additions, but never mind about that. But I think the main reason that most people agreed that it's in the canon is we like it. And it's a bit of a peculiar thing that we like it, but we do. It's even more peculiar that it's in the Christian canon. Because when I looked for relationships between the New Testament and Ecclesiastes, the best they could come up with was, well, it shows how bad it is without Christianity. So, it's really kind of like, well, here's the old deal. This is the hopelessness of life before Christ. So, and here's the contrast now that we have the answer. So Ecclesiastes is really just there as a kind of foil. But that's not what we feel about it. So it's actually one of the most quoted kind of bits and pieces out of it, that lots and lots of familiar stuff in there. And also for people like me, it's got a draw. So I just love it. So I'm not going to come up with any more academic answer than that, but I think it speaks to our experience. And so we tend to come back to it. For a lot of people, it's in their mental canon because of the seekers. Peter, Paul and Mary. Peter, Paul and Mary. They did a version of it. Sorry, yeah. I probably had it on that one. All right, so a bit of background. It's written in that period from 450 to 200 BC, and it's part of what are called the writings. So it's not prophetic literature, it's not law, it's not history. It's this other stuff called the writings, which kind of frees it up, really, because it doesn't have this serious tag. And so it's in there, and make what you will of it. The tradition is that Solomon is the author, and we'll come back to authorship in a little while. But and there are good reasons why it got connected with him, because of the whole idea that the writings have to do with wisdom, and that Solomon was this figure who in history is called the wise one. And so it's a very Jewish thing to do, to attach something that you're writing to something that you've picked up from the past and add to it, and it becomes part of that tradition as well. Its main areas of interest are the meaning of life. They didn't have the life of Brian back then, so they had to have something. So there's key words that spring to mind when you hear Ecclesiastes, like vanity, wisdom, recognizing the transience of human experience, the limitations of human wisdom, and the frustrations and uncertainties that are part of life. And these are all kind of big, major things that we're all familiar with. So my interest today, I suppose, is looking at some of those things and then saying, well, how do we incorporate thinking about those aspects of our life within the context of the framing of our Christian heritage, which tells us a narrative which often doesn't include a lot of that. It's a much more kind of, you know, God's fixed everything narrative. And so I'll come back to that as well. Okay, so going back to the authorship, the traditional link with Solomon is, apart from the connection with the theme of wisdom, is often comes from the second sort of paragraph of the book, where he speaks in the voice of, I was a king in Israel, and, you know, when I looked around and I looked at the world, and these are my thoughts. So there is that voice that the author uses. And so if you take a fundamental view of the scriptures and say, well, that says he's the king, therefore he wrote it, then you would say, well, the authorship claims to be written by this king, and the son of David terminology is in there somewhere. So this proves that it's written by Solomon. And some commentators will still start from that assumption and not question it. Where's my other chapter? A bit on authorship. One of the other ideas about the book is that it's a commentary on existing maxims. So there were a whole lot of sayings that were around, a bit like Proverbs, and the author has collected these up and added commentary to them and then framed them within a narrative. And the third one goes a little bit beyond that and says it's actually a fictional autobiography. So, which is a lovely way to understand it, actually, because when you read it, it can seem very bitsy. But if you see it as this somebody saying, well, I'm going to kind of create this character who frames the book and he picks up all these things and comments on them and plays with them. If you see it as a literary thing, some people would see that as insulting the book, because you've put it in the category of fiction. But I see fiction as a crafting of writing. So to me, that's a high-level comment on the book, not a low-level one. All right, so one of the things I was interested in as I was reading was different ways of reading the book. One of the pictures of the book, which is just it's a collection of bits and pieces that doesn't really have a structure, it just hops from one thing to another, and sees its main emphasis as noting the ups and downs of life with no overarching thesis or argument. So he talks about this and he talks about that, and then he flips over to that. And that suits a reading where you just pick your favourite bits. And there's plenty of them. And it's not a bad way to do it. You can flip through and you can always find something good. The second way of looking at the book is to see it as units of structured thought that have been put in an order for a purpose. And if you look for those, you can create a pathway through there in a number of different ways. So if we look at it in terms of a genre, does that help us to understand it, and does it give us anything extra? And I think it does, because it then asks us the question, who is this voice who's telling this narrative? And what does this person expect from their hearers? And what might that help us to, how might that help us to enter into this story? So one of the genre pictures of where this fits is that this kind of wisdom literature was often written for young men entering what was virtually the public service. And here's some stuff that's going to help them have a good understanding of their role in the world and how they can be useful. And that way of presenting that information is presented along almost the Greek kind of lines of the teacher who stands in a little group of people and has a dialogue with them. So he puts stuff out there. And so I'm going to look at three different ways that role can work: the preacher, the teacher, and the debater. So if you read any of the Calvinist commentaries, they really like the preacher one. And he's this sort of seeing man as doomed to failure and God as the controlling figure, and very much that the voice in the narrative is there to tell you, well, man is hopeless, only God is stable, and therefore the message of the book is, don't trust in human understanding because it's not going to get you anywhere. Luckily for us, God's got it all in control. The teacher voice is similar but is less directive, and it's more about opening the listener's eyes to see the world as it is and to recognise what is good and what is not good, and be aware of that and to have wisdom and discernment about the nature of reality. The one, of course, that I like will be the debater one. The word that's translated preacher, teacher, or debater, I can't pronounce these words, but something like koeleth, was also used for this role of the one who puts stuff out there. And if you think of that old picture of the Jewish men sitting around the gate while the women are at home doing all the work and running industry and getting the family wealth organised, and they're sitting around the gate having their conversations. And the style of these conversations was very much putting out an idea and teasing it out and passing it back and forward and developing it. So the debater voice is one that wants to explore something, makes observations, puts forward theses, debates them, and looks for possible conclusions, but doesn't settle on them too strongly. It aims to goad and unsettle us, and it uses the familiar, which are the maxims, to engage us in new thought. So I'm now going to read to you from the Curly Pajama Letters. I've kind of truncated it a bit for anybody who's not familiar with it. This is one of the Michael Lunig books, and it's framed as letters between Mr. Curly and Vasco Pajama. So, dear Mr. Curly, he writes, I'm still wandering far and wide looking at the world, and now I realise and sort of accept that I am observing and am part of a world which is dying. This is certainly a sad understanding and seems to imply that life is not worth living. But strangely, this is not how I feel. The vital question now seems to be, shall our dear old Earth die badly or well? this matters, I think, and seems to be worth working with and struggling with. How do we attend the dying earth? I ask you, as I ask myself each morning, what is worth doing and what is worth having? These are big questions, and I'm curious about your answers. I look forward to hearing from you, and for the time being, I have my faith and am doing what I can. Yours cheerfully and entirely seriously, Vasco Pajama. He's probably read Ecclesiastes. Okay, so there are a million things that came up. And can I see the clock from there? Oh, yes, just a little bit. So I've picked out a few small things that I want to just say a little bit about. And then my plan a little bit later is to read the passage again and get you to do something while you're listening to it. So here's a few thoughts of things that have come up for me while I've been doing this. I'll just pick a few of the key topics that came out of the reading. To read chapter 3, of course you have to read the whole thing because it's in a context. We'll come to that in a little while. But one of the phrases that you're probably most familiar with, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And it's one of those words which we have to have a look at in because when translations are done, they use the word as people use it at the time. And then time goes by and sometimes we understand that word a little differently. And if you look up the dictionary, it's got two main meanings for vanity, apart from the thing in the bathroom, which we'll just put that to one side. There's vanity which has to do with being vain, and there's vanity which has to do with fleetingness. And so if we look at which one of these is it, is he saying that all is to do with ego and self-deception and is that what life's all about and therefore, you know, not good? Or is it that life is fleeting? And if you look at the word hebel, it means breath. It's actually the Hebrew word for breath. And the idea is that everything is as short as a breath, which might sound very insubstantial, but it's not something you can actually do without, not for very long. You can hold your breath, but eventually you will take another one. So, yes, that life is fleeting and that each small thing is like a breath, which then is gone. But together, all those breaths constitute our life. The question of, you know, what is work and what is worth doing took me to Bertrand Russell. And it was very strange reading Bertrand Russell. I didn't bring the book because I thought I'm not going to read slabs of Bertrand Russell to you. He's a very interesting man of his times. But he does this very prosaic look at happiness and the value of work. And I think he must have read Ecclesiastes too, because it has this same sense of, you know, we have to look at things as they really are and feel the worth of them. All right, so the other one big issue that came up in the book is wisdom, and I did want to read you a little bit about that. This is another author whose name I can't pronounce, so Lindy will have to tell me. Alain de Botton? Botton, okay, yes, all right. Well, Lee can tell me, she's French. But some people de-Frenchify their names and just have an Englishy version of them too. All right. The seeking of wisdom in Ecclesiastes is a very familiar theme, so it's sometimes worth listening to somebody else say something about it just to kind of make us put aside our familiarity and think in a fresh way. We cannot be taught wisdom. We have to discover it for ourselves by a journey which no one can undertake for us, an effort which no one can spare us. Why can't they? Why is this painful journey so indispensable to the acquisition of true wisdom? It is as if the mind was a squeamish organ which refuses to entertain difficult truths unless encouraged to do so by difficult events. Happiness is good for the body, Proust tells us, but it is grief which develops the strengths of the mind. These griefs put us through a form of mental gymnastics which we would have avoided in happier times. Another major theme that frames the passage we're looking at is the search for meaning. We're meaning-seeking creatures. We can't help it. Sometimes when we want an answer, we want something that hangs together and something that is coherent, it can drive you mad. Because it's kind of a, according to Ecclesiastes, it's a lost cause. And one of the examples that came to mind to me is the book Middlemarch by George Eliot, which I read in hospital when I was about 20 and I've read several times since. And Casaubon is driven mad by his desire to discover the key to all mysteries. And he not only spends his own life doing it to no effect, he tries to get his wife to promise that she will continue his work after he dies. And this becomes linked with his whole sense of who he is, and it actually blocks him from having any effective, useful life, because he is so spends all his hours just sitting there trying to work out the meaning of life. And the contrast in the book is with Bathsheba's sister, whose name I've forgotten, if anybody can remind me, who was a very kind of pleasant and stable character in the book. She said when she can't think of something good to do, there's always somebody else's good. And this was how she lived her life. So this idea of the practical engagement in the world and seeking for good out there with other people, and these two characters are very different. The last theme that is dominant in my reading of Ecclesiastes is time. And that's the one that's in the passage that we're looking at today. And so the primary thought I had about the way time is used in this book is as a foil to our modern concept of time, which is about quantity, that how much time have we got, or usually how little time we have, and that it's all to do with chronology and what time you've got to be places. Whereas thinking of time in terms of seasons is inviting us into a large, long picture of our life. And that question of not how much time have I got, but what is appropriate to the time that I am in. So this is my time to do this, or this is my time to do that. Because I'm kind of verging on the edge of retirement, I dread that kind of lack of structure that not being in work gives. And the freedom that I have in work is that if I know I'm doing this now, if it's my time to do this, I don't have to think about everything else. It confines me to one task. And in fact, that's one of the things that Bertrand Russell talks about with work. He says the first value of work is that it fills up the time. Which you think, well, is that a big value? What it is for someone like me? Because otherwise I think, oh, there's 50 things I could be doing now. If I do that one, I can't do that one. And anyway, so to get rid of all that, work has that value as well. Some people don't have that problem. They have a beautiful way of finding their way through the emptiness of time. Okay, so what I want to look at before we spend a few minutes on the passage is the way we relate to Ecclesiastes as part of the Old Testament in the context of the New Testament. I mentioned the fact that, you know, some commentators wanted to kind of not exactly dismiss Ecclesiastes, but really use it as a kind of a picture of, well, this is what life was like without Christ. So I've asked the question, what have we gained in the New Testament framing, and what have we lost in terms of our the richness that is available in Ecclesiastes if we view it only as a precursor to the New Testament? So in the view that now that we've got Jesus, we've fixed the problem, it's kind of almost like a phew, I'm not there anymore. I don't have to think about the meaninglessness of life. I don't have to think about the limitations of human wisdom, because now I've got Jesus and that solves all the problems because he is the key. And I don't have that problem anymore. But it seems to me that if we take that approach, we have to shut part of ourselves down. We have to say, we have to pretend, maybe that's not quite the right word, but we have to live as if we're still not in that human condition that most of us do experience from time to time. When we look at the life of Jesus and the way we see him interacting with those around him and his own circumstances, his own death, I don't think we see that triumphalism of, you know, now we've got the answer, there's no problems anymore. We see signs of realism, neither denial nor capitulation in terms of the fact that life is difficult. Okay, you can breathe a sigh of relief now because we've got to the text. I do find it tricky when I try and confine myself to the text and not do anything around it. So before this chapter 3 text, we have passages that talk about observing the world, the fact that all our efforts are meaningless. And after it, we have the dust to dust idea. But in this passage here in the middle, we have this this very familiar one. I could get you to sing it, but I won't help. Just looking for my version of it. So what I'm going to suggest is that this is a very familiar passage, and what I want you to do is to listen to it again, but I want you to have yourself standing alongside, observing yourself, listening to it. In teaching, we call this metacognition, that you are not only the learner, you are the observer of your own learning, and you stand beside yourself and you watch how you're going and what works for you and what doesn't. So you are the observer of yourself. I call it your evil twin to my students just because they like it. So what's your evil twin telling you about what's going on right now? So when you listen to a familiar passage, you probably go into a zone. So that zone is going to be affected by a number of factors about where you've heard this before. Is there anybody who's not familiar with this passage, like when Julie read it so beautifully this morning? Did any of you think, oh, I've never heard this before? Or is all kind of familiar territory? Mm-hmm. All right, so I want you to think, what shapes your hearing of this passage? Whose voice do you hear speaking to you? Do you hear a teacher explaining the world? Do you hear the preacher encouraging you to a correct attitude to God? Or do you hear a debater who's there to unsettle you, to make you question and wonder, putting ideas out there for you to work through? All right, so here it goes. You can drift off and have a nap if you prefer. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal. A time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence. A time to speak. A time to love. A time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain have the workers from all their toil? I've seen the business that God has given everyone to be busy with. He's made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, he has put a sense of past and future into their minds, and yet they cannot find out what God has done from beginning to end. I know there is nothing better for them than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, it is God's gift that all should eat and drink and take pleasure in their toil. I know that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done this so that all should stand in awe of him. That which is already has been. That which is to be already is. And God seeks out what has gone by. A couple of ironies occur to me in this passage. That the writer writes about the fleetingness of all things and the lack of continuing value, that everything fades and is lost. And here we are, 2,000 and a half or something years later, reading his stuff. He would be a little bit alarmed, I think. This sort of ruins his thesis, doesn't it? So that's a little bit of a funny thing. My main question, I suppose, for us is how do we incorporate the gifts of Ecclesiastes into our Christology? So the work of this writer has not faded in a puff of smoke. Christianity's best efforts to persuade us to a grand plan with a central purpose have not dislodged Ecclesiastes from our hearts. We need to be able to look at the world dispassionately and feel the weight of our human condition. Without this, we lapse into passivity. This is also about balance. Many see Ecclesiastes as dark and pessimistic, without hope, a useful pointer only to the need for revelation of Christ. I see it as an unsettling goad, kind of pronounce that word, to make us attend to both the wonder and the pain of the world. We are encouraged to enjoy God's bounty, but remember the darkness. Far from being a message of hopelessness, this is a challenge to know joy in a world of trouble. To find this joy not by closing our eyes and our hearts to the pain around us, but holding both together. Surely this is what we see in the character of Jesus, neither triumphalism nor despair, but realism in the context of trust in God. Okay, that's it. All right. Does anyone want to say anything about how Ecclesiastes works for them? Have to yell.
It's reminding you that to be present, you know, to not be old and wish you were young, or young and wish you were old, or at some other stage of life or whatever, but be in the stage you're in. And live that role and appreciate it. That's what comes through. And that matches up with the kind of guidance towards being peaceful and happy that comes from the way Jesus said, don't worry about tomorrow. And also other wisdoms, other Buddhism and people like that. It's all about, you know, being where you are. And this is how things are. Yeah, it's not the whole story. I'm sure everyone else got a similar thing, but that's what I got out of it.
It so happens that my lifelong addiction to Scripture Union has taken me through Ecclesiastes for the last 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Well, you probably know a lot more about it than me then.
So I was fascinated by it. And I noticed particularly, and you did come to use it, you talked about the search for meaning or something like that. The latest NIV, you have to say latest because there's so many NIVs, the latest NIV translates vanity as meaninglessness. Book, to me, and the Scripture Union notes of this fortnight are written by an amazing South American lady I've never heard of before. I can't even remember, let alone pronounce her name. But I wrote in my own diary the evening after I finished that fortnight's reading, which was Saturday night. That's just last night. I surprised myself writing. I found the book so positive. And I really think that if you see it as a search for meaning and look at it in the light of the Lord Jesus having given so much meaning to my life, the book is positive.
And I think that word vanity has thrown a spanner in the works for a lot of people in understanding the book.
I completely agree with you. I think the translation of meaningless.
Yeah.
Is helpful.
Well, it's even not far enough for me, because the idea, I mean, the word is literally the word for breath.
Yes.
And our breath is not meaningless. It is short and fleeting.
Yes.
So the fleetingness is stronger for me than the lack of meaning.
So here's another example where the problem we have with interpreting Scripture is a problem of translation. That the original word just doesn't have an English equivalent.
Well, the old use of the word vanity did incorporate that meaning a lot more, but we've kind of dropped it.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, the word has changed. Yes.
Yeah. Yep.
So it's been a real blessing to me these fortnight.
Yes.
Because I'm doing just started work on something called a Doctor of Philosophy. I thought I'd better find out what philosophy was. So one of my Christmas presents was a book called Philosophy for Dummies. And it's so similar, you know, philosophy and not just Ecclesiastes, but wisdom literature like Proverbs, and I would include James as well. Mm. It's not there to tell you stuff, if you like. It's there to get you thinking. Mm. It's wonderful in that sense, I think.
What's the debate on? Thank you for getting us thinking, because I think something that struck... I was at a big concert last night, and something that struck me is there are very few opportunities in our life to do that metacognition, and we're very fortunate that we come to church and actually there's an expectation that we engage in some of that metacognition, certainly in this church. But searching for meaning can be meaningless, but if you don't make space for it, then you just get it gets lost. Mm-hmm. So making space was good.
Just a couple of small thoughts. I also find it very positive. And right at the end, I was just having a peek then, he describes the end of life as when the golden bowl's shattered and the silver cord is severed. And I think he's actually saying that life is very precious, but it's quite a jumble of stuff. But I think the overall message is that it is precious. What was my other thought? Oh, yes, a line of thought that I've come across about the think of him in the days of your youth is from a very practical friend and so happens to be sister of mine, that the discipline of worshipping and learning about God when you're young and able-bodied is to stand you in good stead, so that that is a deep focus that will hold you as... Yep. You fall apart towards death, yeah. And when it's if it becomes a habit of spirit and mind to focus on the eternal, that may carry you through the tough times. When force of mind declines.
Yeah, and also the same idea, I suppose, that enjoy the good things, the blessings of God, eat, drink and be merry. But remember that tomorrow we die, because it's carrying both together that is the sanity and the wisdom. So it's not eat, drink and be merry and that's the reality and that's the only one and just concentrate on that because tomorrow you die, and that's sort of disconnected. It's being even in that good times and able times, as you gain your strength and you think and you engage with the world and you make meaning, part of your making meaning must contain that knowledge of the dark things, that the world is a world of pain and difficulty, and that if you're having a good time now, there's somebody else who's not. So that same idea. Mm.
Thanks, Jenny. That really got me thinking. And at the beginning, you were talking about the debates about who wrote it. I find it intriguing that there's an assumption that it was only one person, because it looks to me like it was thoughts of lots of different people somehow coalesced together, and our discussion about it seems to reinforce that idea that it's lots of different things and looking at things from different angles. And I'm just wondering if there's a reason why they assume it was one person.
Well, some people have a philosophical commitment to the idea that that's what it has to be, and that's the only way I can sustain that, I think. In the end of the book, he actually says, so the speaker in his wisdom continued to teach people what he knew. He turned over the maxims in his mind and sought out how best to set them out. He chose words to give pleasure, but what he wrote was the honest truth. The sayings of the wise are sharp as goads, like nails driven home. They lead the assembled people, for they come from the one shepherd. That is in Ecclesiastes. Yeah, so he has this kind of... this is why I like the idea that it's a crafted piece of writing that has... And there are definitely scholars who say that, the very end bit and the very beginning bit are probably frames that were put on later. But, he certainly talks about the collecting of wisdom as, so some of these bits would have been well-known bits, and the commentary idea makes sense. Mm.
Thank you, Jenny, for your inspiration there. As an artist, it gives me a lot of inspiration there. Just a couple of things. Seeking your meaning of life. And to me, how much time have I got? And there's so much to do and so little time to do it.
Well, what's the time for you now? That's the question. That's Paul's question. So that, if we can actually, as Paul says, you can identify, well, it's my time to do this, then it's your freedom not to do everything else. Because, anyway, we should stop. So.